Yes, thanks for the introduction. So my name is Gijs Mulders. I'm a postdoc at the University of Chicago. And today I will talk about the exoplanet population and how it depends on stellar mass. So in sort of my cartoon vision of how exoplanets depend on stellar properties, you can sort of kind of think of two different axes. So you have a stellar mass axis and you have a stellar metallicity axis. So in the previous talk, we've heard about how exoplanets depend on stellar metallicity. So I'll focus mainly on how exoplanets depend on stellar mass. So as we heard before, the giant planets mainly are concentrated around the more metal-rich stars and also around the more massive stars. This is a trend that we can sort of understand from sort of basic planet formation theory. So the core accretion theory basically predict that if you have a more massive star or if you have a more metal-rich disk, you have simply more material to form giant planets, and it agrees very, very well with this trend where the giant planets tend to be observed in that corner of the diagram. Now, for the smaller planets, it's actually a very different story. So I'll tell you today that actually lower mass stars, they have actually much more of the smaller planets. And this is a little bit of a riddle. So to start with, my conclusion is that planets, and by that I mean small planets, because small planets are generally more common than the larger planets, occur more frequently around low mass stars. And because there's also a panel discussion later today, I'm sort of trying to kick up some ideas during this talk of way maybe how we can explain this, because we do not really understand the implication for planet formation that these lower mass stars have more planets. And so I've heard the term post-Kepler coin discomfort, so I want to sort of start sort of pre-Kepler with the idea of what we thought planet populations were like. So if you look at the stellar mass dependence, so before Kepler, most of the planets were discovered by radial velocity. There were big samples of giant planets that were identified, and within these samples, sort of the planet metallicity correlation has been mentioned, but also there's a stellar mass dependence. So if you go to a sample of more massive stars, you find that the planet occurrence rates are generally higher. So there's a positive correlation between giant planet occurrence and stellar mass. And we can understand this again from the core accretion theory, simply that if a star is more massive, the disk is more massive, so you're more likely to form a giant planet. Disk masses now, we're now in the era of ELMA, but before people had sort of assumed this as well. Disk masses, if you observe them in protoplanetary disks, are correlated with a stellar mass. So these are observations of, I think it's chameleon. So you see the stellar mass on this axis, and you see the dust mass, or the sort of the mass currently observed in small particles in these disks. And you see, even though there's a lot of scatter at any given stellar mass, if you do a regression, you find that there is a positive correlation between the disk mass and stellar mass. So the idea that these more massive stars have more massive disks is sort of observationally very well borne out. So the star-planet connection in terms of stellar mass is really a star-disk-planet connection. Sort of the star and the disk kind of form together. The star sets the amount of material you have in the disk, and that is ultimately what we think sets the population of planets. So we're sort of kind of using the star as a tracer for the environment in which planets form. And of course, if you only have your planetary system left, you can observe your star. You don't have a relic of what the actual disk was. But the star kind of serves as a tracer because a lower mass star would have had a lower mass disk on average. So if you take this basic idea that lower mass stars have lower mass disks, and you take a very simple formation model for the solar system, you kind of expect that low mass stars, in particular M stars, the planets would simply be smaller because there's less mass in the disk. So you would end up with very small, very dry planets. So sort of before Kepler, the prospect for finding habitable planets or habitable zone planets around M stars wasn't very good. Now, as you will hear from me today and also from Courtney tomorrow, this is not what we observed with Kepler. Like, the ideas that we had about planet formation really had to be updated when Kepler came around. So what's the situation with Kepler? So Dan gave a great talk to yesterday about occurrence rates and how to estimate them. So one of the things that came out of one of the first occurrence rate studies with Kepler was that the planet occurrence rate of planets sort of larger than two Earth radii, so these are sort of the sub-Neptunes, or I like to call them mini-Neptunes, has an anti-correlation with effective temperature. So if you go to lower effective temperature, so effectively lower stellar masses, you find much more planets. So this runs sort of counter to the expected trend for giant planets, which would run the other way around. As you have noted, I'm using effective temperature or spectral types as a proxy for stellar mass. So before we had all this great Gaia data, it was kind of hard to get accurate stellar masses for the Kepler sample, and the effective temperatures were much better determined because they're directly more directly based on the photometry. So I'm kind of using spectral types as a proxy for stellar mass, basically going from the high mass stars, the F stars, to the lower mass stars, which are the M stars. So when we looked into this initially about, okay, why are there more planets around low mass stars? There might be a couple of different explanations that you kind of want to rule out. So the first one is detection biases. So we do occurrence rate calculations to make sure that we're not looking at a detection bias, but we're looking at a real trend in the underlying population. The second expectation we had was that, well, if the planets around low mass stars are simply located closer in, that's why you detect more of them. So we looked at how the occurrence varied with distance from the star, with semi-major axis. And what we saw is that we don't actually see a very strong difference in the shape of these distributions. Like, whether you look at F stars or the lower mass M stars, you kind of see the same overall shape, or the occurrence rate is fairly flat if you look about outside of 0.1 AU, and then sort of drops within 0.1 AU. But you see there's a systematic offset where if you go to lower mass stars, you find a higher planet occurrence rate. There's a specific reason why this turnover is here, and after the break you'll hear more from that from Eve Lee, like what the location of this break means, and also about the distribution inside of that break. So the second thing we looked into was planet radius distribution. So basically you can think of, well, you see more planets maybe because there's more small planets. And in a way that's sort of true. So I'll smooth this distribution out a little bit, makes it easier to look at. And so this is the distribution from Kepler, planet occurrence versus the size of the planet. And so what you see is that for these small planets, you really have much more planets around M stars or low mass stars, but the distribution kind of flips halfway through, and then for the giant planets, you have much more. So So with Kepler, you also observe that there is more giant planets around these higher mass stars. But then if you go to the smaller planets, the trend reverses, and you get more of these, more of the small planets around the lower mass stars. And so this trend has been sort of confirmed by numerous studies. So there are a lot of occurrence rate studies out in the literature, so I'll put them all together. You can see there's quite a bit of scatter still between the different studies based on the different assumptions that were made, but the overall trend is fairly robust, that if you look at the occurrence rate, it really rockets up if you go to these lower mass M stars. And there was a very interesting result that came out recently looking at not just M stars, but sort of splitting the sample into different type of M stars. So if you look at specifically the mid-Ms, which are lower in mass than most of the other M dwarfs in the Kepler sample, you see that this trend kind of continues. So the M stars from Kepler are mostly here. So if you look at the mid-Ms, they seem to have an even higher occurrence rate. So this trend that planet occurrence rates keep increasing towards lower mass stars seem to continue even to the very, very lowest mass stars. But the samples are small and the errors are large, so this is definitely an area where new surveys can still improve upon. So then we get to the question of why. So this was not a trend that was expected based on planet formation models. So what does it tell us about the planet formation process? So I kind of ruled out detection biases and sort of the spatial distribution of planets or the size distribution of planets. There's the possibility there's a trade-off with giant planets, because there's more giant planets around more massive stars, you can imagine that, oh, maybe that's why those have fewer small planets, so you can kind of think of it as a trade-off. I don't think this is the case, and I'll show you why in a second. There's also potential with binaries. I'm not going to talk about that, but feel free to ask me a question in the question session. And I think this might tell us really something about planet formation. So to start with the trade-off with giant planets. So you can estimate how much mass is in these planets. So if you take, for example, one of the mass-radius relationships that have been empirically measured now for stars. So here, basically what I'm showing is the cumulative mass, sort of the core mass in planets, as a cumulative distribution. So you see that for M stars, there's simply much more mass in these small planets. And even if you take into account the giant planets, which are sort of here, they don't contribute a lot in terms of their mass in their core. So in terms of their solid mass, like a giant planet has like 10 or 20 Earth masses of solid, so a couple of super Earths is the same amount of mass. So simply because at these short orbital periods, these giant planets are rare, they don't contribute a lot to the core mass. Most of the mass is sort of locked into these smaller planets that really drive these relations. And if you make a comparison with the solids that you find in protoplanetary disks, you see that it's actually quite embarrassing how big the mismatch is. So here is the estimate of how much mass is in solids in these planetary systems that are very close to the star. And if you compare that to the trend that we get from protoplanetary disks, so this positive relation between the amount of mass that we observe in solids versus stellar mass, you see that the trends really don't match up. So I've also added the giant planets here. And you see that those fall along sort of the right line. These positive correlations match as well with this, but for the smaller planets, something happens in the planet formation process that turns this trend into this trend. So what is that? So there could be a couple of reasons, but one of the areas that I think is most promising is planet migration or the drift of solids. So if you go back to this plot, When I showed the disks here, these are disk masses at the size of like 10 or 100 AU or so, whereas the Kepler planets are sort of all within 1 AU. So actually, if you've paid some attention there, actually there seem to be more mass in planet than there is currently in disks, and that's on very different spatial scales. So one of the things that we think is happening is that disks are concentrating their mass very close to the star. There's two processes that can do this very efficiently that have been predicted by theory. One is planet formation, so you basically form a planet in the outer disk and migrate it inward. And the other one is radial drift. So if you have a small grain, like a millimeter or a centimeter in size, that can drift very efficiently in the disk. And this is also something that concentrates material close to the star. So you can imagine a situation where around sun-like star you have some drift and migration, but it's not super efficient, but around these low-mass stars, if you simply make this migration more efficient, you're sort of concentrating more mass, and this might be a way of reversing the trend and getting to the observed high abundance of planets very close to the star. There have been some recent work that was kind of interesting that sort of highlight maybe at different ways of looking at this. So in the early Kepler catalogs, it was the radii of the planets were not fairly well determined. So it was hard to see any trends even within the sample of small planets. So more recently, we had a paper where we tried to sort of rephrase or sort of rethink the planet size distribution, not in terms of planet radii, but in terms of planet to star mass ratio. So this is like what's often done in microlensing because that's there observable. So you take the radius distribution, you take an empirical mass radius distribution, you convert it into a mass distribution, and you convert that into a planet to star mass ratio. And one thing we noticed that, although the M stars don't really seem to match up too well, is that you sort of have a peak that's at a constant planet to star mass ratio. So that's basically telling you that if you go to a lower mass star, your planet is a little bit lower in mass. And there was a different study by Wu, I think it's from this year,
that showed a similar trend, but based on a different analysis, basically looking at the radius valley, and if the radius valley is at smaller sizes around these lower mass stars, that also must mean that the planet masses follow this trend. So I think they find the same trend, even though the analysis is very different, that maybe planets around M stars are a little bit smaller. So that goes along the line that we actually expect, right? We have lower mass disks, we form smaller planets, so that will work out great. The only caveat is that for the occurrence rates to match, this actually makes the problem worse, because if you make your planets smaller, you get fewer planets in the observed size range, but we need more planets in the observed size range. So I think this is an interesting to explore, but I don't think it's the answer to the question. It would actually be better if planets around M stars would simply be larger, because then you could shift some of the small planets into the observed range and sort of get a trend out. But it doesn't appear to be the case. So where do we go? So I have 5 minutes to throw up some ideas of like how we can address this and how we can learn something about planet formation or how we can sort of refine these relations and see where we can go. So the obvious answer is, of course, that K2 and TESS are going to observe a lot of M stars. Well, K2 already has observed a lot of M stars. TESS will definitely observe a lot of M stars. This is the histogram of, I think it's the target list for TESS. So there's a tremendous opportunity to do statistics there to get these relations better refined and better understand the trends, extrapolate them to lower mass M dwarfs, and see how far these trends hold up. Also, maybe in different regions of the sky, things might be different. So things in terms of data, we do have way more data coming up than we had with Kepler. So that's always good. But we do need a homogeneous planet search, and we need to have detection efficiencies in order to characterize planet occurrence rates. And so far, for K2, this has been in the works, and also for TESS, it's not primarily a statistics mission. But it will happen at some point. Then there's the question of which process in planet formation has the right stellar mass dependence. So I painted this kind of simple picture where on the one side you have the protoplanetary disk, on the other side you have the exoplanets, and there's sort of a straight line to that. Well, there is a straight line, but it's a lot of steps. So planet formation is a process that goes from micron-sized grains up to thousands of kilometers, and there is many different processes involved along each line. So maybe this stellar mass dependence is telling us something, that maybe one of these processes has a stellar mass dependence which either suppresses planet formation around the more massive stars or makes it more efficient around low mass stars. And if you can identify which of these mechanisms does this, maybe this is one of the key mechanisms that we need to know to understand how planets that we observe with Kepler actually form. The theoretical predictions, unfortunately, is that most of these processes kind of preserve the initial conditions for protoplanetary disks and turn them into exoplanets. But if there's one mechanism which doesn't do that, and there's a few that have slightly different stellar mass dependencies, I think this is an avenue of sort of pinning down what in the whole planet formation process sets whether planets form at short orbital periods or not. ALMA is also coming up is already been observing a lot. So one of the interesting things with ALMA is that it constrains the radial drift of solids. So one of the interesting things that comes out is that protoplanetary disks always seem to be smaller in the dust than in the gas. So this can be seen as evidence that that radial drift is acting, and basically the solids are being concentrated as sort of a first step of forming planets close in. If you combine this with an observed relation between dust masses and disk sizes, and if I'm going to speculate now, I'm going to say, well, lower mass stars have lower mass disks, so they will have smaller disks as well. Maybe we see some evidence already that there is a concentration, an increased concentration of solids around the lowest mass stars. But this has still to be looked at observationally in more detail. One of the other things is that there are these correlations between stellar mass and disk mass, but there's a lot of scatter. So if you look at the range we probe with Kepler, and you look at the relation there in the scatter, like if you would only observe that range, you wouldn't even infer there is a correlation, right? You can always find an M dwarf which has a similar massive disk as a Sun-like star. So there's a dispersion there that we have to take into account. So on the one hand, it's not so surprising maybe that we find a lot of the same size planets around M dwarfs as Sun-like stars because the disk properties aren't too different. On the other hand, we have this very strong trend in planet occurrence, which you wouldn't expect if the disks are very similar. I think the final thing I'll say is that one of, I think, the most promising avenues of going there is basically doing planet population synthesis. So you can take all your theoretical models that you have of planet formation, throw them together in a big model, and then basically simulate how, let's see if I can get this to work, how planets grow and evolve, and you can sort of predict what your planet population should be based on which physical mechanisms you include. You get this whole fairly detailed predictions of planet populations, and you can test those. So for those of you who've been reading archive, I actually had a paper up yesterday evening, this morning, about how to do this comparison between this type of planet population synthesis models and the observed exoplanet populations. So if you're interested in that, check that out. But since I'm running out of time, I'll just leave my conclusion slide up and take questions.
Elizabeth Newton, Dartmouth College. You had a plot of planet occurrence as a function of semi-major axis. Mm-hmm. Is it surprising that the stars of different masses actually had the same shape?
Yes.
Okay, yeah, it seems surprising.
Yeah, so this is the plot you're referring to, right? So the expectation going into was that low-mass stars would have inner disk extends closer in, so we would expect different distributions. But we didn't see that. So we think that's a sign that the way that the inner disk edge scales with stellar mass is not what you expect based on dust sublimation, but it's what you expect based on the inner edge of the gas disk, so truncation of the inner edge of the gas. So you could see that as an evidence that planet migration creates these curves and they're always the same. So the talk after the break by Eve Lee will go into this in more detail.
James Owen, Imperial. So I have a question about this perhaps discrepancy between the fact that the average planet mass for individual planets is lower around low mass stars, but the total planet mass is higher. Mm-hmm. Around low mass star. You could fix that with multiplicity, right? So is there evidence that the multiplicity increases strongly as you go to lower mass stars?
Right. So you can interpret these results as saying the fraction of stars with planets is higher around M dwarfs, or as you say, like there's more planets per system around M dwarfs. As far as I know, I don't think there's evidence that there's like three times as many planets per M dwarf system than per Sun-like star. So I don't think that if there's a difference there, that effect would be big enough. So I think it's more in the fraction of stars that have planetary systems. So for M dwarfs, it's about 70%. For Sun-like stars, it's about 30%. But we don't really understand why some stars form planetary systems and some stars don't form planetary systems, at least in the observed range. So I think understanding that will be the sort of key to answering that question.
Okay, there's a question in the back.
Svetlana Berdygina, Freiburg. Interesting question would be to look probably at the lifetime of disks. Is there any correlation there? Did you look at that?
Yeah, so in general, the disk fractions are high. Like most stars are born with disks. So the starting hypothesis kind of basically every star has a disk and then can start forming planets. I think there are some observational trends that suggest that low-mass stars have disks that live longer. how that would affect the planet occurrence rates, I think, is not very clear, but it is a trend that would go into the right direction. So that would be interesting to look at.
I want to ask you about the giant planets around massive stars. So correct me if I'm wrong, but I think a lot of those are discovered by radial velocity measurements of red giant stars.
Yes.
And of course, getting the mass of those spectroscopically is extremely difficult, and there's a long-standing debate about that. Can you give an update on that and whether or not those masses are robust?
That's a good question. So yeah, so this is indeed a sample of evolved stars, which were interpreted as retired A stars. But yeah, there has been some discussion on whether that sample. I think sort of making the comparison between main sequence M stars and Sun-like stars, that's where the comparison is sort of easier to do. Although around M stars, because there are intrinsically fewer giant planets, the correlation isn't very significant. I think there have been planets discovered around sort of real A stars, not the sort of main sequence A stars, not evolved stars. I don't know if the samples are big enough to sort of test whether this sort of evolved sample is representative of the main sequence sample.
Okay, I think Dennis is also going to talk about that.
Yep.
So, Eric Guidos, University of Hawaii. So, Heise, I'm glad that in the second part of your talk that you did point out that a lot of these differences could be due to the migration patterns and the difference between low-mass stars and high-mass stars. But I almost wish you would emphasize this at the beginning of your talk, because we must always predicate our statements of occurrence, like Dan Forman-Mackey told us, about what period range and what size range we're talking about. And so, for example, in the period range and size range where we are making these comparisons, our solar system basically doesn't appear. And so it's really the close-in planets that where we see these stark contrasts with the M-dwarfs, as much as I love them. The other point that needs to be emphasized, and again, I know that you're the consumer of this and rather than the producer, but the ALMA plots and the disk mass estimate plots, I kind of almost wish we didn't show them, but I know we have to. And that is because those are, of course, as you showed, really sensitive only to the disk very far out, which may be entirely irrelevant to everything that actually goes into the planet formation. Moreover, the time scale of the observations on which we do this, which is typically sort of the 1 to 10 million year, everything may have happened by then. So in fact, we may be missing the show. And then finally, a little more subtle point, which I didn't realize until the ALMA people actually have started talking about this, is that the disk solid estimates that they give us assume that the opacity or the optical depth of the disk that they're seeing is thin, that the dust is transparent at 7 millimeter wavelengths. But it seems that very close in, this might not be the case. So in fact, this trend may reflect a concentration of dust close to the star where it starts to become opaque, and so our estimates go down for the total dust mass that's available. So we have to keep these in mind when we show these plots.
Right. Yeah, so I totally agree with that. And also, that's the reason why we look at stellar mass dependency, because I think comparing this number to this number isn't very useful, but comparing this trend to this trend, that can tell us something.
Okay, one last question. We can squeeze in. I think there was a hand there. Yes.
Yeah. You mentioned binaries. I'll bite. What do you think about binaries?
I forgot whether I managed to include the slide. I think I did. So the binary fraction. So this has been pointed out to be by several people. The binary fraction is a function of spectral type or stellar mass. So if you look at G-type stars, the binary fraction is about like 50%. If you look at M stars, it's a little bit lower. So there's a stellar mass dependent trend there. So Going back to Max's talk, so if binaries suppress the amount of planets you can have, you can expect a stronger suppression for G stars than for M type stars. So that's a trend that goes into the right direction. Now, if you look at the difference in binary fraction between G stars and M stars, it's a small effect. Like, it's not a factor of 2 or 3 that you need to explain the occurrence rate. So having binaries suppress the presence of planets close in, the magnitude of that is not strong enough, simply because this trend isn't as strong as the observed trend with stellar mass. But it could contribute a little bit. Yeah.
Okay, let's thank Hayes again and all of our speakers for this session. Remember, there's the panel discussion for additional questions as well.